What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours. Like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
Hey y'all, this is Josiah Gray, and this is Half Street High Heat. Hope you enjoy today's episode.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Half Street High Heat. As we are back after, I was going to say a short hiatus, but I guess it's been a week. It feels weird that we're only doing one episode a week, but
I know it feels like it's been a long time.
Yeah, it feels like it's been such a long time, but I guess we're right on schedule, which is good, because, you know, us and schedules, they don't really get along all that well. But we are back this week, and I am joined by Amanda tonight. Ryan is out living his life, having better things to do than watching this team struggle to score runs, which hard to blame him. But you can follow us on Twitter at Half Street High Heat. Follow Amanda at AWhite7877 and myself at The Coach Moose. Amanda, what's going on?
Not too much. Just watched the final out of the 1-0 loss to the Orioles, and feeling like poor Josiah Gray couldn't buy any run support with it, yeah, with Jeff Bezos's money, but it's a little frustrating. But yeah, nothing too much. Just, you know, keeping busy. Lifing. Yes. How about you?
The same. Josiah's like 17 innings and counting now without getting a run scored. And now he's 0-4 on the season, even though he really should be like 3-1. And it's, people are going to go look at the losses, because, you know, there's still those antiquated old heads that are like, oh, wins and losses are solely on the pitcher, and they're very much not. And Josiah Gray is an example of that, because
he pitched great tonight.
Yeah, at the very least he should have like no decisions. I mean, but the fact that you can't score one run, two runs, and then one run, I will concede the second one because they faced Otani. But like, yeah, the one run was against the Rockies, and then this one was against the Orioles with a pitcher who entered the day with an ERA above 9. So that's, yep, frustrating. But I mean, there's plenty to dive into on that, because Stone Garrett, who we will talk about here in a little bit, I mean, he's batting 7th while Dom Smith is batting 2nd, and Dom Smith found himself in some key situations tonight where it would have been nice to have Stone Garrett instead, and or even Luis Garcia, who's been hitting the cover off the ball, or literally anyone else besides Dom Smith, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's great and just great.
Yeah, it's frustrating to see the lack of offense, although not surprising. I mean, we knew this team. They're on a pace to win 54 games right now. Obviously it's very early, which is better than I predicted they're going. Right, exactly. I'm hammering the under on that, but I mean, they're what we expected them to be, but it is, if you ever feel frustrated, Nick, just tell yourself you're not as frustrated as Josiah Gray. So it could be worse.
He's a better man than I am. That's for sure. I'd be raising hell.
Yeah, it'd be tough. That's a tough thing, because all you can do is, I feel like on a team like this, though, and obviously I've never been on a Major League Baseball team of any kind, good or bad, but you...
Wait, what?
I would just...
So you lied on your resume is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. It's called inflation, not lying. yeah, I imagine all you can really do on a team like this, when you know that they're not going anywhere and they're not good, is just do your job as best you can. And he's been doing that. I mean, he had a little bit of a tougher start to the season, but he's been good. His ERA is below four after this start. So,
and the thing is, like, the Colorado start, he looked good, but in the Angels start and now the Orioles start, like, he didn't look his best, but he still battled. And that's all we wanted. Like, that's all we wanted last year. It's like, yeah, you don't have to have your best stuff every single time out. Like, no one does, but we just need you to salvage those starts. And even in the Braves game, where he had like two first inning home runs, he still managed to go five innings. And like, that's all we're asking. And he's doing everything we're asking. And like, the team's just letting him down. It's, you know, we can separate the, you know, wins and losses from the actual individual performance, but it would be nice to have those wins and losses support, you know, the actual individual performance as well, because he's battling his ass off right now. And there's literally nothing to show for it.
Yeah, it's true. Although I remember when we used to always talk about, obviously, with all the caveats, he's not Max Scherzer, but we used to talk about how even on the days when Max didn't have his best stuff, you could always count on him to like eat some innings and give the team a chance to win. And, you know, that's the best you can ask from, you know, his, you know, Gray's not going to have that kind of ceiling. But if your floor is that, you know, once in a while you have a bad start, but most of the time you can be counted on to at least keep the team in the game, I'll take that.
Right. And that's all we can ask at this point. And it's also frustrating, and we've talked about this before, and I'm sure it won't be the last time you talk about this, but it seems like Josiah Gray has gotten the short end of the stick a couple of times already through what, 17 games now. The decision for Davey to leave Josiah Gray in for the sixth and then just pull him after a batter makes no sense, because Josiah was clearly gassed to end the fifth. Like, he did a great job of escaping a jam in the fifth, but he was at 89 pitches. Like, typically an average inning takes at least 15. And that's if you get like, you know, one, two, three, or, you know, pretty quick inning, you know? Yeah. And he certainly wasn't doing that to that point, especially in the fifth. And I think even the fourth, like, he had, that was when he gave up the lone run of the game. The decision to put him back out there is just head scratching. And then he walks a guy, he had him on a 3-2 count, but he threw like 9 or 10 pitches. And then he went to Mason Thompson anyways. Like, if you're going to pull Josiah after one batter, why not just give Thompson a clean inning?
Like, right. Why not give him a clean inning, and why not
no
let Josiah go out on a high note?
The people who like still fight me on the bullpen decisions, like, this is what I'm talking about. Like, there's no rhyme or reason. There's no strategy to this. Like, it's, there's no defending it. Like, I'm seeing actual beat reporters all tweet about it. Andrew Golden, Mark Zuckerman, I believe Jesse Docherty as well. Like, they all tweeted the same thing. Like, why the hell would you put Josiah back out there? Like, I tweeted that at the end of the fifth that they needed to pull him. And it's just so frustrating, because, you know, like you said, he can go out with his head held high, but instead now he walks a guy when he's clearly gassed, and now he has to get pulled. It's like, there, that affects,
instead of letting him, it does, instead of letting him be like, okay, you turned in a good start, like, turn it over to the bullpen now, you know, you leave with a sour taste in your mouth, which, you know, he's already getting no run support. It's just one of those decisions where I don't understand it. Like, what was the, you could have seen by the fifth inning that you weren't getting the sixth inning out of him, so why start? I don't know.
So I just don't really understand. Granted, Mason Thompson got out of it cleanly, as Mason Thompson tends to do, because he's a dog, but it doesn't mean it was a good decision. Just because it turned out well, it doesn't mean the process was sound and thorough. Like,
yeah, sometimes good outcomes come from bad processes, and vice versa. Sometimes bad outcomes come from a good process, but I can live with that. If you do the right thing and it doesn't turn out well, cool. You can only do what was, made sense to do. But when you do the wrong thing and it turns out okay, that doesn't mean you didn't do the wrong thing.
Yeah, and like on that in particular, if you pull Josiah Gray and Thompson starts the sixth and gets blown up, that's not on Gray. So the process is still sound, right? Whereas if you leave Gray in there for even longer and like that run scores, or you left him in too long and now it's a 3-0 ball game instead of 1-0 ball game, like that's not sound process. So it's just frustrating that these issues still continue to plague us day in and day out. But yeah, so that was just our live reaction to the game that just wrapped up. We're recording this on Tuesday night. I was hoping that we would get to the point where it would be two runners on for Stone Garrett so we could live record our reaction
To his inevitable walk off.
to an inevitable walk-off. But both Garcia got the win against Bautista with a nice hit up the middle, and Ruiz battled, but Bautista is kind of a filthy pitcher, so yeah, I think he saw like eight or nine pitches inevitably
It
grounded
was a
out.
good
But
at bat. It just didn't
yeah,
end up.
still in a good at bat from Ruiz there. So unfortunately, we did not get a live reaction to Stone Garrett's walk-off, but we will hopefully save that for another day, and another day when Stone Garrett is batting higher than seventh in the lineup. And listen, for anyone who's tired about the Stone Garrett talk, tough shit. It's going
Strap
to keep,
in, because it's
yeah,
not.
too bad. Cry me a river, because getting him into the lineup was only the start. Now we have to get him into the proper spot in the lineup, and that's going to be a hell of a battle. That one that I am ready. This is my last stand. I am going down guns a blazing.
The hill you will die on.
Absolutely. There are plenty of hills where I don't feel like it's worth dying on, especially with this team. This is that hill. I will die on this hill. This is my last stand. So
A
we
stone
will
hill.
be talking about it. We're going to have a Stone Garrett update segment every single week. So prepare yourself for that.
Until he starts playing poorly, and then we'll just
Well, I mean,
not do it
that's
anymore, and we won't
simply
say
won't
anything
happen.
about it.
It just simply won't happen. He's a dog. All right. Anyways, let's get into our quick pitch segment. Excuse me, if you can't tell, I'm a little bit under the weather today, but I am battling through as well. All right. This one is a little bit of a general question for you, Amanda.
All right.
Through 3-ish weeks of the season, I guess it's a little bit longer than
Oh, what, 17 games?
Yeah. So yeah, 3-ish weeks of the season. What are your biggest surprises for both the MLB and the Nats in particular?
MLB, I guess I would say it's the length of the games. I knew that the pitch clock was going to have an effect on game length, but how quickly the games go. I feel like I'll turn it on at 7 o'clock while I'm, like finishing dinner and getting the kids, doing homework and doing whatever it is we do. And by the time I get them into bed and come down, the game's either over or almost over. And that was never the case, almost never the case before. So that has definitely been a welcome surprise. Although I do almost find the pace, it's nice. I don't dislike it, but it's almost just a little bit like it feels rushed. Not in a bad way, but it's, I don't know. I'm not accustomed to it yet. And then surprise for the Nats. Yeah, I don't know. They're pretty much doing what I expected them to do. There's nothing all that surprising. I think to go back to Stone Garrett, he's been a very nice surprise so far. He's not got enough at bats to, put any stock in it,
I mean,
really.
I'm not
But
surprised. I expected that shit.
well, I didn't expect it to be quite it, like a batting over 500 is pretty surprising.
No, I expected that. I called. I'm pretty sure I said that in
Another
my
thing
bold
that
predictions.
is something I did expect is Meneses' regression, and that's been I mean he's hitting what 224 I think after this game, so just thoroughly
Also
mediocre,
expected
which
that.
yeah, that was not, again, as I was saying, it's not really surprising. So I don't know. I don't have Robles, I guess I'll go with Robles as my nice surprise. His approach at the plate has been a good surprise, although there's a few things in his stats that are alarming. He's the exit velocity is 84.4, which is in the bottom 3% of the league. And hard hit percentage is in the bottom seventh, 25, which is the bottom 7% of the league. So while he's been better and his approach at the plate is better, and his batting average is over 300, which is definitely a surprise to me, the underlying metrics are still not what you'd want to see for like a true hitting resurgence. But I'll say Robles, so I have to pick something.
I would agree with that. I don't know if you can hear my dog literally actually having it like a dream right now.
That's so funny. So is mine. She's like squeaking in the background. I'm like, I hope nobody can hear my dog making adorable dog noises in the background.
I was like, what's going on? I thought he was like barking at something, but nope, just having a dream. All right. Scintillating podcasting here. My general one for MLB is actually I'm going to say the Rangers, but I really mean kind of the hot starts versus slow starts around the league. Okay. Like some of the teams you would have expected to get off to hot starts, like the Astros, for example, same division, you know, they're fine. I mean, we're through 18 games of the season or whatever. I'm not declaring anything now, but the Astros are kind of middling, where it seems like the Rangers, albeit only 10-6, they've dealt with some injuries. DeGrom left to start early again, but they're still finding ways to win games. Corey Seager went down with an injury. Their lineup looks like, you know, nothing to write home about as of right now. When it's healthy, it looks good. And they're still finding ways to win games. So that's kind of interesting to me, because I picked them for a playoff spot, but I didn't think that it was going to be convincing. And the way they're winning right now isn't necessarily convincing either, but if they can find ways to win games without being convincing, that usually is an indication of teams that are good to make the playoffs, right? Like teams mm-hmm. that win the games they're not necessarily supposed to, or can win ugly, or, you know, whatever it comes down to, a win is a win. And through, you know, the first 3 weeks of the season, the Rangers are showing to do that. They're, I think, staff pitching as a whole, ERA is ninth in baseball. So that's kind of where a lot of their production is coming from. And, you know, that's where they spent the bulk of their money this offseason. So if that can hold up, I think I'm looking good on that prediction so far. So that's kind of interesting to see so far. And then for the Nationals, honestly, my biggest one, and I just tweeted this out, is how many close games they're playing. I thought this team would get absolutely blown out. And 11 of their last 12 games have been decided by 2 runs or less.
That's a good point.
The 12th game was a 10-5 win over Colorado. So basically the Colorado series on, like, they've played really close baseball, which is good and bad. It's good because this team's scrappy. Like, if that's the adjective you want to use, I think it gets thrown out too much. But I think in this case, it kind of applies. They're still close in games, whether it's the pitching staff like battling their ass off, or the offense kind of being pesky, poking singles, not striking out a lot. Like, this team has scrappy aspects to it, but it also, on the flip side, is just like a harder, you know, stronger gut punch.
Yeah. Because, the losses, like, feel worse when they're close. Yeah,
exactly. Like, we have somehow, some way, a little bit of hope, but it's mainly because, like, we're trying to manifest good performances, like we talked about, for a guy like Josiah Gray or Mackenzie Gore, or, you know, some of the hitters in the lineup. Like, we want them to do well, and, you know, it sucks seeing them not be able to, you know, reap the benefits of their hard work or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you look around the league, the Nats were compared to the A's a lot to start the year. It was like Nats or A's. So, well, the Nats through what do we say, 17 games so far, they have a minus 21 run differential, which honestly is not that bad. It's about 1.5 per game.
For a 5-12 team, that's not a bad
run. Not bad. The A's, you ask, minus 72.
Wow.
So it's like that in, you know, there's more examples. Like, if you want to go to Detroit, who's 7-9, but they have a minus 42 run differential. So it's like, this team is finding ways to be scrappy, and it's just, if we could get a little bit more timely hitting, if we could just get a better lineup construction, like, I do think we can win some games. I'm not ever going to call for this 2023 Nationals team to be anywhere close to 500, but I do think, like, we are better than our record reflects, as crazy as that sounds.
Well, like, this team's going to
lose a lot of games, but
optimistic Nick. And yeah, it's interesting. And I would prefer to see a team that's, you know, to use your word, scrappy. I want to see a team that cares. There's nothing worse than when your team is terrible and they clearly don't even care and they're getting blown out and they're not trying their best. And like, that's miserable to watch. At least close games are watchable games. You know, they have a chance to win. And, you know, that's really in a team in the middle of a rebuild that has a roster as bad as this one. Like, being close and having games that you want to watch into the ninth because there's a chance they could win, like, I'll take it. It's better than it could be when you look at teams like the aforementioned A's and Tigers.
Right. And like, that just kind of goes to the sorry, I completely lost my train of thought, but what I was trying to say was the run differential. It's kind of credit to how good mainly the bullpen has been, but even the pitching staff, they went 11 straight starts going 5 innings or more. And like, that helps because that doesn't tax your bullpen, and that makes your bullpen more effective because they're not having to pitch long innings and long games every single day out like they had to do last year. So if you look at it as a whole, like, some of the stats are inflated. Obviously the Kyle Finnegans, and, you know, even Rosmer Ramirez and the Chad Cools, and we'll talk about Patrick Corbin, but Patrick Corbin's early starts, like, those will inflate the numbers.
Do we have to talk about Patrick Corbin?
We will. And you might be surprised, but right now the Nats are 19th in team ERA, like, as a whole, both starting staff and bullpen alike. So it's like, they could be better if they could just get some more timely hitting, which is a big ask. I understand. And this isn't really necessarily optimistic, Nick. This is just me. And this is what I'm trying to do. I said this in the last episode, the episode before. I'm just trying to call it like I see it. And this team should be better wins and loss wise than they are. And a lot of that has to do with the manager, honestly. And people are going to disagree with me. Fine, whatever. I don't care. But I know I'm right because I'm watching these games. Like, I can't say I've ever watched this, not ever, but since 2019, watched this many Nationals games to start the season. Because I've watched basically every single one of them, and I'm seeing thoroughly invested for some reason. I hate myself, I guess. Like, watch these games, and I'm seeing the decisions that are made and not made. And I can tell you that Davey has cost us like 2 or 3 games already this year, and it's frustrating seeing a guy like Tim Boger come in and win us a game. And I'm not gonna dive down that again, but back to my point about the biggest surprise is just how many close games are playing. Cause I did expect us to be maybe not minus 72, but like the Royals, for instance, they're 4-13 and they're minus 42. So like, that's kind of what I expected, but this team's keeping it close. If we can just get some more timely hitting here and there, we might find ourselves, you know, playing 500 ball. Not that that is where we'll finish either.
That makes sense. Well, I have a quick pitch for you, actually.
Oh, we're quick pitching the quick pitch.
There you go.
I'm gonna call a pitch clock violation.
I'll get one with Josiah Gray. It's good company. So the Atlantic League, which is where baseball's, you know, always testing out their new rule changes, has 3 rules they are testing out of the Atlantic League this year. First one is a designated pinch runner. Just super interesting. Basically, you could put a runner in, and the player who substituted out, as well as the pinch runner, would be allowed to come back into the game. Interesting, right?
So, say that again. I saw the rule, but I didn't look into the
specifics.
Okay,
so designated pinch runner, and this isn't even my favorite of the three. So, of the three, there's the designated pinch runner, which means basically they would let you substitute a player in as a pinch runner. And then when that, you know, the inning ends, the player,
the original guy goes
out,
back.
Could go back in, and the pinch runner could be used again later in the game.
So this goes for any player, not just like the pitcher or catcher.
Right. Exactly. For any player.
Don't like it.
Okay. The second one is, I think we can expand on that. The second one is the single disengagement limit, which is basically just like a sleight of judgment where pitchers are limited to disengaging from the rubber only twice now, but it would be only once.
Also don't like that.
This one is my favorite, number 3. the double hook designated hitter. And we talked about this when there was still no DH in the National League. So this is already in place in the Atlantic League and has been for 2 years. But obviously in MLB, this would be a huge change. So this would mean that the teams would only be able to use their DH if their starting pitcher makes it through 5 innings. If the starter's pulled before the end of the fifth, the team must either hit with the replacement pitcher in the DH's spot or use a pinch hitter.
Also don't like that.
Oh, God, I love it so much. Please give me something.
So I wouldn't mind a tweak to that. I actually presented this to you.
Yes, we talked about this, right?
When the pitcher comes out, you lose your DH. But that's kind of, actually, I guess that kind of fits. But on the flip side, now my opinion, it hasn't changed because like I'm just being stubborn. We just already have the DH permanent. Like, let's just leave it. And I also think it's going to lead to more guys getting paid and the DH being recognized better for like award voting or Hall of Fame voting or whatever. So I think now that it's here, let's just leave it. And I think it is going to be good. I understand the desire for strategy and I don't hate them toying with the idea. I just don't necessarily want to see it.
Yeah, I, as you know, am a DH hater, but I really do. And I know I don't bring it up because it's a moot point. It's done and there's no going back, or maybe there is. But, you know, I don't like it. I find it a little bit more boring. And I know everybody's like, more offense, it's more exciting. I miss having the, you know, the pitcher spot come up and you have to decide what to do. I miss the old National League rules. So I would love it. This is like if the starter comes out before the fifth inning, these rules would come into play. I would love to see what we had talked about before, which was just when your starting pitcher comes out, your DH comes out, and that you just tie them together. And that's kind of a hybrid, really, of the rules from the two leagues, what they used to be. But anyway, I just think it's super interesting. They're doing this already in the Atlantic League since 2021. So I don't know if it'll ever come to MLB, but I would love it if it did.
Yeah, I mean, I think I get the Atlantic League, you just play around with rules and not all of them will make their way to the MLB and that's fine. I think it's good to have a league like that. The single engagement makes no sense. I think.
Yeah, I agree
anything,
with you. I don't like
if
that
anything,
one.
You need to go up one more, not down one more. But I'm not advocating for that either. I think it's fine how it is.
Yeah, I don't like the single idea. Why do you hate the pinch runner idea? It's really kind of a radical change. It's never been allowed in MLB for a player to be substituted out and then go back in again. Like that's a pretty radical change.
I don't like that because I think I don't like it because if anything, you should just leave it. If it was for the catcher, for instance, I think that makes sense because player safety, or not necessarily player safety, but you know, they're having a lot of wear and tear on their legs. And like, if you pitched it to me in that way, I would understand it. But now we're getting into the kind of weird back and forth and just kind of all over the place nature of the game. Like for you, for instance, you were saying pitchers should be able to hit. Right. And, you know, we can get into the fine details of that argument again, but like the actual position players should be able to hit and run.
And they should be able to run. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So like, that's kind of where I know that was a terrible way of explaining my thought process, but this is a quick pitch. And I'm processing on the spot. But yeah, they should be able to hit and run because they're not having to worry about like a whole other aspect of the game, like pitching. Like if anything, they would be getting pulled because they're slow, and like that shouldn't be a factor in the whole equation, in my opinion. If you wanted to do it for catchers, I guess, but I still think that's kind of a ticky-tack rule.
Yeah, and I don't like it. And that was kind of the slippery slope argument I used when we talked about why I didn't like the DH. Like, why is the pitcher the only one? Like, why not just have an offense and a defense? You know, that's kind of taking it to its logical conclusion to me. But I would rather have no pinch runner and no DH at all. But it's just interesting. I don't know that I'd want to see it because you're right. It kind of starts to make the rules sort of, I don't know, messy.
Yeah.
Is the wrong word, but
Yeah,
it
that's
just
probably
feels
what I
like,
was trying to get to. My brain wouldn't get there. It just, yeah, it does get to a slippery slope
I
territory
laugh
about.
at when you ever watch baseball with somebody who doesn't watch baseball and they're just like, what the hell is going on? There's like all these weird intricacies to it. And, you know, every, I don't know, if you don't watch baseball or understand it, I understand when people tell me they think baseball's boring, because if you don't understand it, it is boring. But like, this makes it's just like one more complexity layered over the top, maybe a bridge too far.
Do you like how baseball is played right now? I know you don't like the DH, but just as a whole.
Is played in what way? Would he just like the general rules of the game?
Yeah, general rules, strategy. Again, I know you don't like the DH, but how do you feel about how the game is right now? The game, not the Nationals.
Yeah, you know, I love baseball, but I, you know, and you know me, I'm something of a purist. I don't love how pitcher or starters only go 4 or 5, maybe 6 innings, and it's so much bullpen. I think that I enjoyed watching the game more, and I'm older than you, obviously. When
You are?
starters used to go deeper into games, do you know what I mean? And like, you would see complete games a lot more often. I don't know. So there's some things about it that I don't like as much as I used to, and there's some things I like more. You know, the pitching is so much more incredible. Like, it's like witchcraft what some of these guys can do with a baseball. So that part of it I really enjoy, and I love a good pitcher's duel. I love to see, you know, if you could show me Ohtani versus Gerrit Cole, I would love it. Even if nobody scores a run and it winds up being a 1-run game in the 14th or something, I would sign on for that. But so yeah, in some ways I like it more, and in some ways I like it less.
Yeah, I was thinking about this today because someone else asked me about the pitch clock specifically, but just the rule changes in general. I like how it's played right now. I do hear you on the strategy aspect because it feels like almost every other sport there's some sort of strategy to the game, like through like in-game strategy, I should say. Not like just putting lineups together or anything like that. There's in-game strategy, there's play calling, there's other things that baseball doesn't have. Like you can run plays, but it has to be certain situations. You can't just do it, you know, on your own accord. So I wish there was more strategy, but I don't have a perfect solution to that. I do think you should expand rosters to what is that, 26? I would like to see 28. But maybe cap the bullpen numbers, which I think the bullpen's capped to 9 guys right now. You can only keep 9 bullpen guys, or maybe 14 pitchers in general, which I'm fine with that. I would like to see more bench players. I think if you had more bench players,
You
you
could
would
have
see
more
more
strategy.
strategy. But players also might not like that because then owners would retort with, "Oh, well, we're paying more guys major league salary, so we can pay you guys less." Like you get into that whole
It's
messy,
always the money, of course.
right? But I think having more guys would contribute to strategy, and I think you would see less guys injured or even go on the injured list if they're just able to sit out for a couple of days without like hurting their team's, you know, lineup for the next day or roster spots or anything like that. But my follow-up point to you is, do you have a or a follow-up question? Do you have a rule change idea in mind that you would like to see implemented?
Well, that's a good question.
We're just going to go questions back and forth all
I know
episode
that's the
long.
whole episode, right? I
Yeah.
like it. A
Yeah.
rule change I would like to see.
I
Well,
have
I
one if
mean,
you want me to
other
start.
than the obvious one, yeah, like I'd like to see no DH in either league. I would love to
All
see,
right,
or
that's
to
not
go
happening.
back. Yeah, but
Give me
or
a
to
new one. Give
go
me a fresh
back to,
idea.
okay, no interleague play and just have them play
Oh,
each
I
other.
hate that.
I
I
liked this.
despise that.
No, I don't despise it. I loved, that's again back to when I was younger and watched baseball. Like, it was so special when the teams played each other. You know, it was the World Series. That's when they played.
But
There were major leagues.
we talked about like the benefits of playing everyone because
It's
baseball is so
fun.
regionalized.
I
Like
know.
you wouldn't have seen Shohei Ohtani this year. And I get like it was a West Coast game anyways, but like you know, you're cutting off half the league to viewership that is already like struggling to keep paying
I know,
attention.
it's true. And you know, I don't know, I'm just kind of throwing things out there, but it was just there was a real specialness to it that is lost. There's something that's missing now. There's nothing special about interleague play, even before this year, when obviously everybody plays everybody, but even before that,
I
like,
mean, it might not be like as special as, but like you shouldn't play like the Yankees, for example. I always remember it was a big deal when the Yankees came to town. You shouldn't play the Yankees like once every 4 years. Like, that's just silly to me. Like the 2023 Yankees are going to look vastly different from the 2027 Yankees. Like, you're going to completely miss out on players. And that makes no sense. And I don't know exactly how long it would be between an interleague play, but I like that they play everybody because, yeah, it's only a series, but in the grand scheme of things, it's still 162 games. It's still, you know, a dogfight to get through the summer. Yeah. You know, you're not really impacting the grand scheme of things by switching up the opponents, or not even switching up the opponents, just like almost like giving more parity to the league because you are playing everyone. You're not just going to reap the benefits of a weak division, or you're not going to struggle just because you're in a strong division.
It's true. And I didn't like 19 times per year for the same team is a lot. And yeah, I'm glad that's not the case anymore.
I mean, that's almost half the season just against your division. It's a lot.
It is. And maybe that's another rule change that I wouldn't mind seeing the number of games shrink a little bit.
Well,
I wouldn't
want to see it
shrink too much.
Oh, you're saying the MLB season shrink.
Yeah, seeing the whole season shrink.
I think 154 is a really good number.
I do too. And I like the uniqueness of how many games there are in baseball and how it's such a slog to get through the season. And when you get to the end, mm-hmm. like the teams that one of the things that I've always loved about baseball is whatever team you have in your head, you field on opening day, hopefully is not the team you're going to finish with. There's going to be injuries. There's going to be changes. There's going to be trades, whatever it is that happens. It's the teams with depth. It's the teams with good farm systems that actually can make it and be on top of their divisions and make a deep run. Like almost always you're rewarded, not just for the team you field on opening day, but for the completeness of your entire organization.
Yeah.
In a way that I think more than any other sport.
Yeah. I completely agree with you. And I think shaving off 8 games is still going to continue to capture that. The essence of just the long grind of a season that is so special about baseball, but also kind of give something back to the players to promote player health and, you know, just, I guess, satisfaction. Because if you want to dive into the X's and O's and business of it all, like their employees, you kind of throw a bone to your employees to keep them happy and, you know, keep the on-field product good, you know. But you actually just gave me an idea. I have another rule change that I would like to see, but let's say it is 154, which I don't know that it'll ever go down. If anything, they would lengthen the season because then you get into revenue. And like you said, mm-hmm. the money, always about the money. But if they do shave it down to 154, I would like to change the All-Star break format.
Mm.
I think the All-Star game needs to be on a weekend. And I think the players would love the opportunity to get a full weekend off, and you would see more players participate in the All-Star game if they weren't sacrificing days off, because a lot of the guys pitch Sunday, I'm gonna take the week off, just go spend it with my family, even though they're an All-Star. And I get it, but like the MLB could easily switch that up so that way the last game played isn't the day before the All-Star game, you know. So I what I would do is last game of the first half of the season, or first half, whatever, be played on Wednesday. Thursday off, home run derby Friday night. Friday night home run derby would absolutely hit.
It would kill on ratings on TV too.
It would hit. Saturday night, I get Sunday night baseball is always kind of a big thing. So if you want to do like home run derby Saturday night and then All-Star game Sunday night, I'm fine with that too. Whatever. Just keep it on a weekend. So either Friday, Saturday, or Saturday, Sunday, and then give the players Monday through Wednesday or Monday through Thursday off the next week. I think you would see so much more participation in the home run in the All-Star break. And I think the players would love it. And, you know, if you're going to add some off days, I think that's a logical place to put them because players really enjoy that time off. And even if they don't make the All-Star team, right, they really only have like 4 days off before they start playing on like Wednesday or Thursday. So it's a break, but it's a short-lived one. Whereas a week off would just be like a bye week in football, you know, where they have the week off to reset and You know, you're going to get some guys off the DL, or sorry, the ILs, my apologies, back. And that seems to be a recurring theme of my thought process tonight. But
yeah,
I think it just makes a lot of sense to kind of put your main event, aside from obviously your playoffs, on a pedestal. Why, like, why put it on a Monday and Tuesday night?
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree. I would love it on a weekend. And you'd get, for people being able to attend.
Yeah.
Like, I understand it's a big deal to go to the game, but like, if you're, for somebody with kids and a job and all that, like, you know, you can't always take off work, or your kids have school in the morning, or you can't get it. You know what I mean? Like, putting it on a weekend, not only does it make the TV ratings better, but I think it makes it more accessible to more people, and not like they have trouble selling it out, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, people might have an opportunity to go who just aren't going to do that in the middle of a week.
Every other All-Star break is on a weekend. I mean, the Pro Bowl is kind of a joke at this point, but even that's on a weekend. And then the NBA All-Star break, which used to be the best All-Star break, always on a weekend.
Just not NHL, the best anymore.
Always on a weekend. Like, Monday, Tuesday is the worst possible. Even like Wednesday, Thursday would be better. But for Monday, Tuesday is like,
yeah, it's like the worst possible time.
Worst possible time.
I've got another one for you. How do you feel about the three batter minimum rule?
Haven't noticed it, so I don't mind.
I don't like it. I don't like the rule. Everybody always talks about how the DH is so great for all these different reasons, one of which is it makes more jobs for guys. Well, what happened to the loogie when they went to the left-handed, or you know, the left-handed?
I mean,
guys
learn to pitch against other hitters, like.
I know. My point is just, if the whole idea is like, let's have jobs for more guys, that definitely eliminates.
No, that's fine. But again,
I like the drama of like going to your bullpen for one guy against this one guy. Do you know what I mean? I kind of miss that.
It takes forever.
I know it does.
That's why
they
did it. I
sort of miss the drama of it. I know. But you know, honestly, I feel like they did all these little tweaks that did essentially nothing to shorten the length of games.
And then
now they actually
They could have just done the pitch clock.
Yep, they could have just done the pitch clock and left all this other stuff alone. But
yeah,
I don't know. I kind of miss the loogies.
Oh, I mean, you are the first and only person to have ever said that.
I think it's fun.
My rule change would be something I do think will inevitably come to baseball.
Okay.
And that it is not robot umpires, but it is challenging balls and strikes. Because I think that is like the happy medium. Baseball will never go to robot umpires. I guarantee. I will put my every dollar I have on it.
I think they will.
No, they won't, because the umpires would have a fit. Like it would never happen. I guarantee you. Guarantee you. Name one other sport that has robot umpires and no like real life officials.
Well, that's not like you have no real life officials if you get rid of umpires calling balls and strikes. I'm not even arguing for or against it, although I am for it. I think they should go to robot umps, but I think they will eventually. I think it will happen.
I think
people said that about replay before it happened.
No. Well, first of all, the people arguing against replay is dumb, but no, the robot umpires, you're going to see the hanging curveball, the one that like drops in late for a strike, that's going to get called a strike. Or no, sorry, drops in late.
Ball,
right? Yeah, and gets called a ball. That's going to get called a strike because it's tracking where the pitch goes. You're going to get a lot of.
I think the answer is robot umps with balls and strikes being challengeable. So that if the robot ump calls something, then you can go back and look and be like, obviously this was a strike.
I mean, that would be backwards, because like if you're going to challenge the robot ump, then you're going to challenge the just efficiency of every single pitch called. Whereas if anything, you should use the robot ump to be the tiebreaker if the batter and umpire disagree, or the pitcher and an umpire disagree on a strike call. You should use the robot ump as the tiebreaker.
Well, if they're going to miss calls, you know, if they were the ones calling them, then I don't know. I think if you're going to allow them to be challengeable, then you should have humans looking and making the determination about.
No, well, that's what I'm saying. That was my point until you argued with me. I just do think they should be challengeable because, I mean, I was watching the game today, and my God, it was one of the most inconsistent strike zones I've ever seen in a non-Angel Hernandez game. Like, it was just asinine how inconsistent. It's one thing if you just are calling a ball or calling strikes high, calling strikes out, whatever, if you're consistent about it, because then the players can adapt. Whether they agree with it or not, they can at least adapt. But to call it inconsistent, like you're, it's a guessing game, and there's no benefit to be had from that. There's no adjusting to that because we just don't know.
Because you have no idea, right? If something was called a strike two at bats ago and now it's a ball, you're like, well, how the hell am I supposed to know what to swing at and what to let go by?
Right. And like this, granted, it happened to the Orioles, so like I'm not broken up about it. But there was a situation tonight where the Orioles backpicked at first base. Adley Rutschman threw over. It was, he was set up inside. The pitch was low and outside for a strike. But because he had to reach across his body and then had a snap throw to first base, the umpire did not see it was a strike when it was very clearly a strike. Like that should be one, if the manager taps his head, should be reviewed really quick, because that's not necessarily the umpire's fault. Like with a lot of going on in front of you, you're going to miss that more often than not. It just happens. That's not, I'm not even blaming the umpires at that point. And I'm not also not an umpire defender, but like that kind of pitch or that kind of play should be able to be reviewed, because you know, that's helping everyone in that instance. Granted, the Nats got a benefit of the call, but it could very easily happen to them as well, you know?
Right.
So I would like that kind of situation to be reviewable. I think it just makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I don't, I think you're probably right. I think that is going to come.
I mean, but, I am.
Well, it had to happen eventually.
Yeah. So yeah. That was a good discussion. Nice little rule change. Everyone.
Yeah. It was impromptu. We didn't have that one planned out, but
yeah. Anyways, the Nationals, they play baseball.
Ish.
Actually, before we get back into Nats talk, it did work last time. So we are going to pause and get a word from our sponsors.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, we are back and talking Nats, which, you know, they need to pay. They need to pay us more to talk Nats, but here we are. I'm looking up a stat really quick, but I know what happened tonight. I believe it happened two or maybe all three games in the Guardian series. So I'm trying to stall while I look this up. All right. I sort of stand corrected. The Nats did not draw a walk tonight. And there has been several times in the past couple of games where they did not draw a walk. And I think that really contributes to their lack of success. Yeah, it happened on Saturday as well.
Their stinkiness. Yes.
Right. Because with this team, we know they don't have power. Like that was a surprise to no one when they didn't have any power. Yeah, so they had three walks. Oh, sorry. So it's just Saturday and today. But still, they only had three walks on Sunday and three walks on Friday. But like when the team doesn't have power, you need to generate base runners. And without, you know, this team hitting a ton of extra base hits, like getting guys on by any means necessary is so crucial to success. And I think a lot of the lack of offensive success has to do with this team's inability to draw walks and just see pitches and have long at bats. Like, oh boy, it's a shame Ryan's not here, because the Dom Smith rant would be second.
It would be good. We'll have to wait on that. Stay tuned.
I know Dom Smith had a bloop single tonight. I know it. But once Dean Kramer and the Orioles realized that Dom Smith couldn't hit a fastball, Dom Smith didn't hit a fastball. So like it's just frustrating to see a guy who is penciled into the heart of the order 2-3-4 in somewhere in there, and can't hit a fastball. But not only that, is consistently swinging at fastballs outside of the zone.
And but leads up, the up team the with 6 walks.
Dom Smith does?
Dom Smith and Victor Robles tied for first on the team with 6 walks each.
All right, well, that just contributes to my point, because he can do it, but he's actually not doing
no,
it.
No, I'm
right
sorry.
Now.
I stand corrected. Alex Call has 9.
Yeah, I was going to say Alex Call seems like you should have more.
I was looking at the wrong. I didn't scroll down enough. 9 is the team leader with Alex Call.
But also, like, to bring up Alex Call, I'm glad you did, because that supports the Stone Garrett argument we're going to get into. Like, Alex Call literally can only draw walks. If we're talking about his offensive game, he doesn't hit well. He doesn't hit for power well. Like, he was literally only having so much success because he was drawing walks and, you know, just waiting on pitches to hit. He was just seeing a lot of pitches. Through, like, the first 2 weeks of the season, he was, like, top 7 in baseball in pitches seen per plate appearance. And so he was filling that role well. But when you're not walking, your game gets completely exposed. And that's kind of what's happening to the Nats, because they can't get on base. Like, they've been a singles-heavy machine. If you're not hitting, you have to be able to get on base in other ways, and they're just not able to do that right now. But again, we kind of expected that with a guy like CJ Abrams, Luis Garcia, K-Bear Ruiz even, who, like, aren't necessarily known for their walking capability, but that's just who they're going to have to be to, you know, gut through these cold stretches with the bat. Like, you have to be able to still get on base, and the Nats aren't doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent point. I'm sitting here looking at, you know, team numbers on things like walks, and it's not good. I mean, they've only got 49 on the entire team so far, which is, I don't know where that ranks. I don't have that number in front of me in MLB, but it seems like an awfully small number. A lot of the guys, you know, like Lane Thomas only has 4, and he's who we've got leading off most of the time. I mean, you need more walks out of a guy who's going to be hitting that high in the order. Not that there's anybody hitting behind him who's much of a threat, but still, it's something that you want to see. And, you know, you brought up Alex Call. He's got 9 walks, but only 10 hits. So, you know, and that's in 59 plate appearances. So the numbers are not impressive.
No, they are not. The Nats in walks are, sorry, still scrolling. They are 22nd in baseball.
There you go. Still scrolling. That should be hashtag still scrolling when you're looking for the Nats in lists of stats.
For reference, the New York Mets are first with 88 walks.
Okay. So we'll see. So 49 versus
nearly
88.
Doubled.
How many strikeouts? Where do the Nats rank in strikeouts? They've got 103 so far.
They have the lowest. They don't strike out a lot. Oh, you mean pitching or offense?
No, I mean offensively. How many? Where do they rank strikeouts wise?
Oh, they're the best. They have the fewest strikeouts in baseball.
Wow.
Because they just hit weak ground balls. So yeah, they're a good contact team if you want to use the actual definition of the word. But it's not like they're putting the ball in play. Like, if you look at the Guardians, they are great at just dinking and dunking and blooping and finding their way into manufacturing runs, because they run well, they put the ball in play, and good things happen because they have the exit velo to go with it, and not just, you know, these weak rollover grounders that the Nats seem to love. But yeah, if, you know, you're betting against the Nats, don't bet the over on strikeouts, because I don't think it's hit a single time this season. Maybe once or twice, but I think McClanahan hit. But
how's your hot streak going, by the way?
So I was in Texas over the weekend, and them Texans down there don't believe in online gambling. So
I had to
take a little brief hiatus, which is why you have not heard from me as much. I threw out a couple of lottery plays, which are just like high odds, unlikely to hit tonight, just to see if I, you know, caught fire on my way back, and none of them hit. But that was kind of to be expected. So we're going to get back at it tomorrow. And I know my fans are eagerly awaiting.
Yes, I know you've been on this hot streak, and then nothing all of a sudden. Like, what's
well,
coming?
Yeah, it was just the trip. And plus, we've had some off days. The Nats have had a couple of off days over the past couple of weeks, and they have another one on Thursday. So kind of breaks it up a little bit. But I'm still 33-17 on the season. So 33 for 50, if you want to look at it that way.
I love it. That's good
So
stuff. I don't
six,
gamble
six,
at all.
seven.
I don't even know what all the terminology means. So people talk about gambling, I just like my eyes glaze over. I don't do it.
Yeah. So, all right, but back to Alex Call. So the Alex Call Stone Garrett conversation is interesting to me because, well, first and foremost, Stone Garrett needs to be in the lineup. Like the fact that he's played in a third of the games at this point, and I believe leads the team in extra base hits. Amanda, if you still have that page pulled up, he might be second
Let's
to Candelario because Candelario has three or four home runs at this point.
get Stone Garrett's got what, 9 hits, 3 doubles,
A home
one
run.
home run. Yeah.
So he has
And
four extra
two
base hits.
walks.
And how many does Candelario have?
Candelario has let's
I
see,
believe he has.
19 hits, 3 doubles, 3 home runs.
So yes. So we're just gonna call Stone Garrett second. Lane Thomas might be up there too, but we're gonna call Stone Garrett top three. I think top three, safe to say, without having the stats right in front of us. Like he needs to be in the lineup. In a team like we talked about, desperately lacks power, lacks extra base hit capabilities. He needs to be in the lineup. Whether you believe in him as a everyday player or not, does not really apply to this because he's proven he's a spark plug to this offense. Like you can't deny that. And I don't necessarily dislike Alex Call either. Like I know Trey, who does our YouTube page, big fan of Alex Call. You know, for what he is. I'm not I don't
He's
want to
not a
put words
world
in.
beater, but he's a
Yeah, I
good
don't want to put
piece.
words in Trey's mouth or anything. But like Alex Call is very serviceable, but he's limited in what he can do. That being said, I think he's a fine fourth outfielder. I just don't think he was long for being this team's everyday outfielder, or everyday left fielder, and leadoff guy. Like the design was for him to platoon with Corey Dickerson. So I think we've already seen too much of Alex Call, and that's not an Alex Call. That's not his issue. I just think that was never the design, and he got off to a hot start, but now he's severely regressed, and that was kind of to be expected because we didn't anticipate him being an everyday outfielder anyways for this team, like when they were initially designing the outlook of this team. So if that was the case, then why not insert Stone Garrett already? Because that just fits your plan to platoon Alex Call. And if Stone Garrett's massively outperforming Alex Call offensively, which he is right now, then Stone Garrett deserves those everyday reps that you were giving to Alex Call. Like that's just the logical explanation behind it. Again, whether you believe in Stone Garrett or not, like that them's just the facts.
But the guy's only got 18 at bats right now. I mean, it Candelario's got 71. He's leading the team in plate appearances, and then Lane Thomas, and then Joey Meneses, and then Dom Smith. And I mean,
Go
there's just
ahead.
no, the thing with Dom Smith is just I am baffled. I don't even know what to say about when you look at his statistics versus Stone Garrett's. Now I understand you're like, oh, well, Stone Garrett hasn't, it's a small sample size. Then give him more at bats so it can be a bigger sample size. Like what are we doing? Stone Garrett has a .563 batting average right now, and Dom Smith has a .232. Why is Garrett, when he can get in the game, hitting seventh? When was Dom at second in the two hole tonight?
Second, yeah,
I
and
mean,
it.
I just, what are we doing? What are we doing? And you know what? Do you know what's Dom Smith's barrel percentage is?
Oh, it's low. It's
It's
very low.
zero, Nick. It's zero.
Yeah,
It's zero.
that actually, I should have known that because Ryan had mentioned something similar last week. Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's crazy. I'm sit you know, you sit here and you look at these stats and you're just like, Dom Smith's his stats are awful. He's in the bottom 10% of the league, bottom five in a lot of things, and tons of different offensive, statistical categories. He's got a 25% hard hit percentage. It's the bottom 8% of the league. His exit velocity is 85.1, which is in the bottom 10% of the league. I don't understand why is this guy hitting second. I understand this isn't like a powerful lineup, but you have better options. You have better options. Why are we?
It's like
I don't get it.
if anything, you should have just left Candelario because Candelario was hitting second there for a while. And
Right.
then Candelario started hitting and then Davey moved him down to four. And it's like where is the logic here? Like you don't put a guy who you're trying to get right in the two hole. Like you just don't.
Right. When a guy is hitting like Dom Smith is hitting right now, you put him at the bottom of the lineup and hope he can get right. That's what you do. And that's what he's done with a lot of other players. It's what he did with Robles for the longest time. Like, you hide him at the bottom of the order because it's not complicated. The higher in the order the player is, the more at-bats they get. Your best hitter should get the most at-bats. I don't understand all this, like, you know, this weird, you know, we're going to do this
God.
Here. So
the dumbest argument I got was like, oh, well, he's having success in the nine hole. Let's leave him there. Like, if you were having success at your job, should you not get promoted? Like, what?
Right.
Like, what is?
They're having success as
here?
A cashier. They don't. We shouldn't move them to management. Like, what are you talking about?
Like, it's like, just...
yeah, I don't get it. That stuff just really. And this goes to the broader argument, which I know we've talked about before, and you rant about on Twitter all the time. Is the lineup construction is nonsensical? I just don't have words. I see the lineups come out every day, and I'm like, what are we doing? What are we doing? I don't know. We've had these discussions already. I want to like rehash everything we talked about on the last episode, but yeah, I am befuddled by the lineup decisions.
Yeah, because it's all on Davey's gut. Like, there isn't like I don't have it in me to watch every press conference or like catch up with every press conference, because like the stuff that comes out of his mouth is just like just complete bullshit, if we're being honest. Sorry, it is. Like, it's all coach speak. It's all, there's no like actual data or firm reasoning behind it. It's all what he wants to do, which if he came out and said that, I'd be like,
this would be a great segue into the comments that Juan Soto made this week about lineup construction.
Yeah, we will definitely get into that, but it's like Davey just does whatever he wants and he sticks to it. Like, him and Rizzo both refuse to admit when they're wrong. And it's like, as humans, you're not going to get everything right. You're just not. But, you know, what makes the good managers great and what makes the good GMs great is knowing when to pull the plug when they are wrong.
Right. And when to pivot and when to be
when
like,
to pivot,
hey, this didn't
and when
work.
To try something
Let's try
new.
Something
it's like
else. Yep.
Luis Garcia got one at bat or one game in the leadoff spot, went 0-for-4. I get it was a bad performance, but like we haven't seen him there yet. We haven't even seen Robles bat higher than eighth, and he was hitting .450 for like the first 2 weeks of the season. It's like Dom Smith and Joey Meneses just get penciled into the middle of the order because of this like power that you think they have, but they haven't displayed at all. Like, at least Meneses has had some, but he doesn't have a home run yet. And it's like Candelario has been your best power hitter, but you move him down in the order, and Stone Garrett is your best power hitter, and like he plays once a week. He got benched for six straight games. Six
straight
games.
Yeah, that part
games.
Wasn't even like a, hey, we're going to move him around. We're doing like six games. That feels like punishment. Like,
and
what are we doing?
Yeah, exactly. And Davey tried to say that it was matchup based. Like, first of all, that's complete bullshit because your lineup is heavily righty based anyways. And also, when we finally, as a collective community, bullied him into playing Stone Garrett, who did he face? Shane Bieber. What did he do his first at bat? Doubled off Shane Bieber. Like, it's like, if you want to go into matchups, be consistent with your logic. Everything that comes out of his mouth is complete, like an utter fluff. And it's a PR statement. And he just can't admit when he's wrong. And I get he's a nice guy. Guess what? He can be a phenomenal bench coach for another team, but he's not management material. You like, just separate 2019 for a second. His overall managerial record is like a .410 winning percentage. It's not good. It's not good. And it's for reasons like this. Like, he has never been able to construct a well-rounded lineup unless it's been flat in his face, like the 2019 lineup and how stacked that roster was. But if you look at 2018, 2018, that team still vastly underperformed. And even 2020, like, they couldn't even make the playoffs in an expanded playoffs in a 60-game season. Like, he's underperformed at every single step of the year. 2019,
and I wish
they started
people would
19
stop.
To 31.
I wish people would stop and think for a minute if that ball doesn't get past the outfielder in the wild card game in 2019, and the Caps don't even or Caps, sorry, the Nats don't even get into. I'm thinking, speaking of teams that miss the playoffs. Yeah. But if the Nats don't even make it into the playoffs because they lose in the wild card, like, we're having a very different conversation about Davey. He's probably
Absolutely.
Not even still here. And that is taking nothing away from what they did in 2019. But that was lightning in a bottle. That was magic. That was the baseball gods smiling on us. That was, I don't know what that season was. What that season was not was some sort of like you know, some sort of incredibly impressive managerial display. Do you know what I mean? Like it was all of these things falling into place, and Davey did a great job with some of the managing in those playoffs. Although I wouldn't say even I was all that impressed with his managing during the regular season that year. But he, you know, it went the way it went, and I wouldn't trade that World Series for anything in the world. But if you could just step back a little bit and be a little bit dispassionate and take that out and say, okay, other than this one October in 2019, let's look at his tenure. I mean, you can't, if you're being honest with yourself, you can't defend it.
Yeah. Like if you look at the Cubs, like they won in 2016, you know, Joe Maddon really underperformed for the next 3 years before they inevitably let him go. And, you know, there's been other examples of like Joe Girardi, for example. You know, he was a World Series winner, and granted, he got a very long leash before they inevitably let him
go. Well, winning a World Series will buy you a lot of time.
And yeah, for sure. And I'm not saying like Davey should have been fired after 2019, but can we not accept the reality of the situation in that this, every single team he's had has underperformed aside from 2019? Like we're entering
and
year,
they
year
underperformed in 2019 until they went on that
games.
Hot run at the end. Right, yeah. Exactly.
So
I don't know. It's definitely that year was magical and it was awesome. And, you know, but the league and all of sports really is full of both players and coaches/managers who had one really good year, you know, one really good performance. I mean, look at, you know, I would say Cody Bellinger, except he's actually starting to round into form here a little bit right now. But, you know, like look at guys who do it once or twice and then they can't sustain it. Like what makes somebody a really great at what they do is the ability to consistently sustain a high level of performance. And, you know, you can look at lots of guys who had one MVP year or coaches who won one World Series and could never repeat it. And I don't know how anybody looking honestly at the totality of Dave Martinez's coaching tenure can look at that and think, this is a guy that we want leading us to a World Series in the future. Like we think this guy can help us win another World Series. And if he's not a guy you think can win another World Series for you, then what are we doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's not where I intended the conversation to go, but I do think it's still valid. It's going to be valid pretty much every episode until a change happens, because we've had a ton of, you know, sample size to give us the opinion we have now formed, but not much to the contrary. But if you look at tonight's lineup, for example, giving Lane Thomas the opportunity to lead off, I have been very strongly against Lane Thomas leading off. I pulled up all the stats. You know, I'm not going to dive into that. 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts. Kind of what I was saying, like Lane Thomas, not a leadoff guy, but I was fine with it because Alex Cala was doing it. Now has struggled, and now you need someone there. So fine, whatever. But Lane Thomas is not your leadoff guy. Don Smith batting 2. We already talked about that. Joey Meneses batting 3rd, 0-for-4. So you're 1-through-3 in the lineup went 1-for-12 with 6 strikeouts and no walks. And it's just like we kind of knew that was coming already. Like Joey Meneses is the only one with a real argument to be there, and that's a weak argument at this point. Because we're clinging to 2022 Joey Meneses and not looking at the reality of 2023 Joey Meneses. Can he turn around? Absolutely. But I'm just saying. Whereas a guy like Jamer Candelario, Luis Garcia, Stone Garrett all deserve to be up there. All have very strong arguments to be up there. Even CJ Abrams. His might be a little bit weaker than the other three, but still. And it's just frustrating that we're getting the same, you know, recycled lineup over and over and over again. Like even Franzen said, it was Franzen or Carpenter and said on the broadcast at the start of the game, it's like, oh, it's kind of the lineup we've seen a lot this year. Well, yeah, because Davey doesn't change anything like ever. The one time he did was the Stone Garrett game where he hit Stone Garrett 2nd. And it was awesome. Like,
and it was awesome. Why aren't we doing that?
Like, yeah, like the Alex Call leadoff experiment worked great for like 3 games. And then it didn't, because that's not who Alex Cole is. But I get the thought process, so at least kudos there. But, you know, being so stubborn to never change your mind is just frustrating. So Anyways, let's get into some highlights before we jump back into, I guess, some more negative talk, which I didn't even intend this episode to be so negative, but listen, a lot has happened. But
we've been
let's
through
talk about,
some shit, okay?
Yeah. Let's talk about some highlights. Mentioned two of them. Jamer Candelario, Luis Garcia hit the cover off the ball last week. Garcia had two home runs. He was 5 for 12 in the series against Cleveland. Had the moonshot on Sunday's game that brought them to within one. Obviously, we know Stone Garrett has been raking, but he only got one start in the past week, which is just asinine. But Jamer Candelario, like we said, just rounding in form. He's someone interesting because switch hitter, has shown great defense this year. And if he's starting to hit for power and extra bases, which he's been doing lately, like he's going to be a hot commodity at the trade market. Mm-hmm. Granted, we have like 3 months to go, but if this can continue to some capacity, it's not just, the Nats could trade him. The Nats would need to trade him because he's going to get something pretty good in return, regardless of his contract and it being a rental. Like that's something to monitor. So come on, Jamer, like let's keep hitting. So that was good to see. Lane Thomas also had a good week, but again, Lane Thomas had a good week hitting lower in the order than what he did today. Pitching wise, Mason Thompson, awesome dog, my pitcher or reliever of the year. The other one, if we're being honest, Patrick Corbin. Patrick Corbin was 2-0 this week, if you can believe it. He had the 5-inning, 4-run performance against the Angels, which doesn't look great on paper, but the Nats won that game, and he held Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani to nothing that game, and the Nats kind of did it that series, which credit to the Nats for fighting against the best duo in baseball. And then obviously he had the quality start on Sunday where he went 6 innings, 5 hits, 2 earned runs, no walks, 4 Ks, and 94 pitches. So it's like, listen, we've ragged on Corbin enough. We're going to inevitably do it again in the future. Like, we got to give him some credit where credit is due. He's had 2 great starts. Show me at least a third and then we'll start talking.
Yeah,
but
got his ERA down to 6.3.
Oh, we're in business now, baby. We are in business now. So those are some of the good highlights over the past week. There was little individual ones like CJ Abrams had his first hit off what'd Ryan say, a non-cutter or a non-slider this year, whatever it was. He had handled a 95-mile-an-hour four-seam fastball to the top of the zone for a nice piece of hitting up single up the middle. So that was good to see. His defense also looks great. He had an error day before last, but he's made some really, really like good looking plays. So it's nice to see that ironed out. Yeah, he should have had a stolen base tonight, but Victor Robles was hell bent on bunting, fouled off a bunt when CJ probably could have stole third on the same pitch. Mm. So little things
Robles
here and there.
Had a little bit of a rougher week than he had before.
He's facing more righties. It's gonna average,
and he had like that really uncharacteristic defensive
blunder.
Error.
Yeah,
that was you don't see that from him very much. We're just totally miscalculated and wasn't where the ball was coming.
The ball just had a little bit more life than he anticipated, which it happens. Like just like bad starts happen, just like slumps happen. Mm-hmm.
Just doesn't happen to him very often defensively. Nothing. Nothing but good things to say about his defense.
I think that's more of an anomaly than like a sign of things to come for him, because he has played pretty good defense. Maybe not quite to the caliber we expected, but still solid defense. Like, I haven't had any issues or concerns with his defense this year. But I do think offensively, first of all, it was never sustainable for him to have a 450 batting average over the course of the season. But also, like, the Nats are just facing more righties now. Like, they faced 3 righties in the Guardian series. They faced, 2 righties, I believe, in the Angels series. They faced a righty tonight. So he's just seeing more right-handed pitching. He hasn't had a day off all year. Scheduled day off. He's had off days, or you know what I mean.
Where he didn't play in a game.
Yes. Yes, he's played in every single game. So these happen. These lulls happen. Like, if you still look at his numbers as a whole, still 288 batting average. I get that's front-loaded. It is what it is.
Yeah, if you told me at the beginning of the year we'd be talking about him having a 288 batting average 17 games in, I would absolutely take that.
Right, exactly. So little things here and there. But there were some good performances. I didn't mean to be too entirely negative. But that being said, there was some news that came out, or at least a story that came out today, that did generate some waves within the Nationals community. So let me pull up this guy's name so I can cite my sources here. Jake Russell, he is a Washington Post sports writer. Actually, I don't know even know if it's him, because I think it was from SI. I think he was just citing
reporting.
It.
Okay.
Yeah. So the article was from Sports Illustrated. I'm trying to see who wrote it, but I don't see an author's name. But anyways, SI, good enough. Stephanie Epstein. Anyways, they were talking to Scott Boras about, and Juan Soto, just about everything and the trade and his contract status and all that stuff. And Boras was speaking and basically said last year he asked Soto whether or not going forward he would consider refusing to negotiate in season when asked about a potential extension with the Padres. And Soto's response was, "I wanted to do it with the Nationals, but they just made it public. I didn't like that at all. I hated it. I told them we weren't speaking anymore because they just threw everything out there. If the Padres can keep negotiations private, I can do it anytime. I have no problem with it." Which, if you go back and listen to the tapes, we all said it was the Nats who leaked the numbers because they just were not happy with negotiations. And that's when negotiations soured, because it was not very long between the time that number came out, the 15-year, $440 million contract came out, to the point where the Nats started trading and then obviously traded Juan Soto. There was not much time in between. And also, Scott Boras doesn't have any leverage by leaking the number.
No, I mean, we all know that. We all talked about it at the time. We all knew it was the Nats who leaked it. But to see a guy like Soto, who wanted to be a Nat and was willing to negotiate with him, I mean, maybe he would have gone to free agency anyway. I think he probably would. But if he was willing to negotiate with them, and, you know, the reason that it never went in, and I remember they're saying, oh, he never even gave us a counter. He was pissed off because you leaked everything publicly. It's this generational player that you should have done everything you could. And it did exactly what the Nats wanted it to do. What they wanted was for the fans,
the PR
blindly,
spin.
Right, yep. For them to be able to say, they offered him $440 million and he wouldn't take it. Screw that guy. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But what you did was make him an offer and then publicly leak it to pressure him. And he was pissed off. And we knew that at the time. We knew it. Because we suspected it at the time. Now we know. Now we know that that's what happened. And it is infuriating.
And it's like, Scott Boras has had so many big name clients. So many big name clients. Show me one time where he's leaked the contract negotiation.
Yeah, there's no benefit.
There's
to
no
the player.
Leverage to be gained. There's none. Every single player wants their contract negotiations private. Scott Boras would not do that. I get, for some reason, people hate Scott Boras, and it's such a dumb, I'm sorry, it's a dumb way of looking at it, because he is good for baseball. Whether you like it or not, he's good for baseball. To Amanda, you said it perfectly. The Nationals put it out there to spin the narrative, to shift the blame to Scott Boras, to Juan Soto, rather than the team. Was the 15 years, $440 million a bad offer? No, it wasn't. I can honestly say that. But it was way under market value. It just was. To lock up a guy that early.
Yeah. But did
you
want
to
win?
Pay market value or above.
Did you want to win? Did you want to get Juan Soto to be on your team for the rest of his career? Or did you want to just make some PR spin so that you didn't have to pay him and the fans weren't mad at you? Because that's what it feels like to me. You didn't actually want him in the first place, because you had to know that by leaking it, you were going to piss him off.
And also the first offer, I don't remember what it was, but the first offer was
outrageously low.
Very, very low.
Yeah, 350 or something.
It was 10 years, 330 or 350, something like that. Which, you know, AAV doesn't look terrible, but I mean, look at this offseason example. Everyone got 10-year deals till they're 39 or 40, because that's just what the market's demanding. We go back to the market price and the market, what the market's saying, it's yeah. Anyways, so that came up again, but also they asked Juan Soto about hitting second, and Juan Soto said, to kind of full circle this, that he did not like hitting second in Washington, but he's open to doing it in San Diego because of the line of protection he has. But in Washington, he didn't like it because he didn't have a lot of line of protection, as we were saying. And yeah, Juan Soto hitting second is good on paper, but if you don't have a protection, like, he's going to get pitched around. So he'd rather hit third or fourth because, in theory, you have more guys on base for him and he's not getting pitched around so much.
Like, and it's not even just what he said that he didn't mind it. It was what, also, the way he said it exactly. He said, what was the exact, I'm trying to pull it up here. The exact wording was like,
he also brought it up.
I told
to
the manager
Davey.
That, yep. That Davey does what he wants.
Yeah.
Or something
he,
like
he
that.
He said he brought it up to Davey, but the exact words was he does his own thing or he does what he wants.
And I get that, like, people, and I saw people on Twitter defending Davey, like, oh, you know, of course he does what he wants. He's the manager. The players don't get to make lineup decisions. I understand.
But that's
if
your
you
star
have,
player.
That's your star player. And he is
you have to value
the best
his
hitter since Ted Williams. Like, what? Value his input. Give, and he was right. He shouldn't have been hitting second in that lineup.
And all, like, anyone who's saying, well, Soto sucks now, like, you can just walk right out the door because you just don't.
Yeah,
you know, if, like, you're not providing any value to this conversation.
Right. If somebody says that to me, then I'm just like, okay, well, I'm not going
yeah,
to try
you're
to
just
have this
one
conversation
of those guys.
With you because this isn't going to bring any.
Yeah, like,
we're not
going to
convince
no
each
value,
other.
No value to the conversation.
Yeah. It devastates me that Soto is not going to be, like, of all the players we've lost, and there have been, as we know, there have been, it was Harper, it was Rendon, it was Turner, it was all these players who should have made an effort. Soto is generational. Soto is somebody who you should have never, ever let walk out that door. You should have done whatever you needed to do to keep him. And people, oh, you got to build a line. There's no salary cap, okay? You can build whatever kind of lineup around him you want to. But that kind of guy, you don't let go. And you certainly don't screw around and make him upset and angry and bitter and not want to be a part of your organization ever again. Do you know what I mean? That it's so, as a fan, it's somebody who follows the team closely, but just as a fan, it hurts to, like, this guy, not only would he, you know, did we have a chance to have a guy who's going to go down in the history books like Ted Williams, maybe, but, you know, he actively dislikes this team now. Like, this isn't a guy who's going to wind up back here in free agency one day or something. Like, he's never going to want to have anything to do with this organization again. And that just should never have happened.
I know Ryan's point, and it's a very valid point, would be, if he was here, that this is a common theme with players that leave this organization. They do not have.
Rendon was a good example.
I'm like, I'm at the end of my podcasting limit with my cold. So I apologize if I sound gross here, but, like, not many have had kind things to say about the organization. Rendon, like you just mentioned, had very choice words and very particular words for the organization. And I'm trying to think of more examples, but again, my brain's kind of failing me at this point because I'm under the weather. But
Turner didn't seem very happy.
Yeah, Turner. Oh, yes. Yes. Out. Thank you. Trey Turner was just questioning what the hell was going on with the organization.
Harper.
Yeah, that I'm sure fans will kind of try to claim Bryce is an outlier, but he kind of saw it firsthand because he was the first one to go through those types of negotiations. And, you know, there's been several others that of highly, like, notable players that just aren't thrilled with how the organization is being run. And I get that that's not, like, comfortable to hear, but it doesn't make it any less true.
Like, and doesn't it seem to me, and it's a weird thing, it always seems to me that the players who are less superstar-y, players who are less important organizationally, tend to have great things to say. Like, they get treated really well and they love this organization, but the superstars don't. And that's a really interesting.
They love bargain bin. They love, like, you know, kind of the cost value or cost benefit, whatever. Analysis.
But I think it speaks to a larger, like, that's the point, is it speaks to a larger sort of mindset of the Lerner family and the organization of, like, we want to go out and get these guys who we think we can fix them, or they're coming off of an injury and we want to get a bargain on them. And, you know, they go all out and try to try to build the team that way. But when they have superstars, and some of these guys fell in their laps, and you know, Harper, obviously anybody in the world would have drafted Harper with the first overall pick that year. But, you know, a guy like Rendon, who went sixth, who fell that far, like you had a guy who, and obviously retrospect being what it is, Rendon's not doing so great right now. But point is, at the height of his powers when he was here, like they not only didn't re-sign him, but he left here bitter. Why is it that the best players that have ever played here felt disrespected and not treated well by this team? I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, but it is a theme, to your point.
Yep.
And it's too much of a theme not to notice at this point as a fan.
Yeah. So I guess the good news is we don't have any more of those guys to for it to happen to.
You know what? It's an excellent point. We don't have to worry about that
Spin
for a
zone.
while. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was just it's all a moot point, like you said. It's over and done with now. We're not trying to dredge it up. It was trending on Twitter today, so we had to address it. And again, it contributed to the theme that's been going on. And you know, I still love Soto, and it was hard to hear him. Like, someone pointed out, oh yeah, I'm sure he was crying at, because there was a report that he was crying all morning the day he found out he was traded. He's a 23-year-old kid. Of course he's probably crying. Like,
Yeah, that's hard. You're whole uprooting your whole life. And
yeah,
I think that
uprooting your whole
you
life,
don't
like,
really see, you've never been traded before. You don't really know. You don't know that city. You
you're
don't know
going to
anybody
feel
there.
some type of way if the organization, if you like, that's the first time Soto's probably felt the shitty end of the business.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think it was necessarily wrong of the Nats to trade Juan Soto, because keeping Juan Soto, like, this team has so many holes as is. Like, right now they wouldn't have a shortstop. They wouldn't have a 2-3 pitcher. They wouldn't have, you know, the farm system that they do. Like, their farm system is so top heavy as it is, and that's all due to the Juan Soto trade. It's literally has nothing to do with the Max Scherzer Trey Turner deal, which is just insane. Like, that,
The fact that we traded, I mean, Scherzer, obviously, he was a rental and you
but
weren't going to get
Turner,
a haul
and
for
I
him. But
love Gray, love
Turner.
Ruiz, but like, the fact that our farm system has like nothing to show for them, and you know, is entirely reliant upon the Juan Soto deal, is just crazy. But it just hurts to see like Juan Soto be so hurt by the organization that, you know, is supposed to do right by the players and by the fans, and they're
You
just
know what I
not.
was
And it
thinking
just
about?
contributes to like our thought process that the learners have been checked out for several years because they don't care. They got the World Series and they're looking to cash out. They're literally trying to sell the team. Why the hell are people still defending them?
I don't know. But you know what I thought when I saw that when they first traded Soto and they saw that he talked about how he cried the whole morning and he's so upset. I found myself thinking back to the story of when they were signing him as an international player and they offered him $1 million and he
Yeah.
agreed and shook their hands. And then I think it was the Mets offered
The
him
White
like
Sox.
the White Sox offered him like millions more. And he said,
It
no, I
was
gave him
three
my word.
million.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I gave him my word and I don't go back on my word. And I kept thinking to myself, like, man, what a shitty way for that
Yep.
relationship to end. You know, I don't know.
Yep.
That's just a hard one to take.
So.
All of them were hard to take, but the Soto one is the for me personally, I can't speak
Yeah,
for
and
everyone,
it
but for
has.
me, that's the hardest one to
We're
take.
not, yeah, again, we're not even talking about the trade. So don't come at us saying like that the trade was like we won the trade. I don't, that could not matter less to the conversation we're having. We're talking about the relationship and, you know, the way the business was done. We're talking, you know, we talked about the process for making decisions with the lineup and in-game management. Now we're talking about the process with the, you know, the general manager in that kind of process as well. Neither of which have been done effectively, in my opinion. And that just goes to the point that I think both Davey Martinez and Mike Rizzo should be gone. But it likely won't happen until ownership changes, and ownership change probably won't happen until the Masson deal is resolved, and the Masson deal won't be resolved until the Orioles relocate, and the Orioles won't relocate, like on and on and on and on. So we're just stuck.
Masson deal, like after you know the sun goes supernova and the earth is destroyed, the Masson deal will still be tied up in court.
Death, taxes, and massive
The
deal.
Masson deal. There's no escape.
No escape. So, anyways, all right, let's wrap up the show. You got any final thoughts? Your one big thing before we head out?
You know, I mentioned it earlier, kind of took the wind out of my sails, but I had been really excited to see Cody Bellinger kind of bouncing back. He had a five hit night, was it last night, whatever the last game was, and he was one of those players that, like, I hate the Dodgers, so I never really rooted for him too much, but he was always one of those guys where he hits that MVP year and then just like forgot how to hit. And I was thinking to myself, like, what is up with this guy? How did he just, I want him to go someplace else for a change of scenery and like be successful. And to see him with the Cubs, like, maybe it's too soon to say he's back to his MVP form, but that one is just like from a baseball fan perspective. I always really enjoy when a guy that everybody has written off like comes back somehow. But it's fascinating because I don't understand how you can slump so hard for so long and then somehow find it again. But it seems like he is, so.
Yeah. My one big thing is just a timely piece of humor. Lucas Giolito took a no-hitter into the sixth inning today. Oh, well, really until the seventh. He got pulled after six no-hit innings because he was at 102 pitches. And the bullpen couldn't complete it, but I just thought that was funny. And I get, like, Giolito has kind of been up and down with the White Sox. He had that one great season and afterwards, like, has not been the model of consistency, especially in 2022. But I mean, he had three very solid years, two and a half if you want to count the COVID season. But anyways, I just thought it was funny. Like, hey, there's our old friend Lucas Giolito, doing well without
Oh,
us.
untouchable prospect, Lucas Giolito.
Well, not even that. It's just the whole development argument,
Yeah.
player development argument, and just the conversation we had today about management and general management and prospects and all that stuff. I was just like, oh hey, there's another one. There's always something.
Yeah, it
Always
seems
something.
like, it seems like a lot of former Nats have success elsewhere, which is a whole separate argument. And I'm sure that's true if you die, if you kind of drill down on any team, you're going to see guys that end up with other organizations and do better. But it does seem like when the new ownership takes over at some point, I do think that's going to happen. And when it does, I just hope that there's a complete overhaul of the player development staff and we can start. I want to be even more than that, maybe not more than I want, not more than I want to win World Series or anything, but I want to be a team where people are like, I want to get prospects from the Nats because their minor league system is so good because they develop players so well. We want the pitchers they've been developing.
Right.
Wouldn't that be something?
That would, but here we are. So,
And yet, here we are.
yeah. So that does it for this episode of Half Street High Heat. I think Ryan will be back next week. We'll be back with our regularly scheduled programming, but we appreciate listening. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Half Street High Heat. Amanda at AWhite7877, myself at the Coach Moose. Be sure to check out halfstreethighheat.com, districtondeck.com for your latest Nationals baseball, or I was going to say Nationals, MLB, college baseball, everything in between. We got you covered every single day between those two sites. And check out Half Street High Heat on YouTube. Trey posting multiple videos a week, multiple shorts, sometimes on Twitter as well. So we got you covered every which way. We love it. Somehow, apparently, we just love to hate ourselves. I guess.
So I tell Ryan earlier, there's no hate stronger than self-hate. It's the
Right.
best kind.
Right. So cool. Cool. We're on it. All right. That does it for this episode. We'll be back next week. And in the meantime, let's go, Nats.
Donuts.
There's a new breeze blowing off the banks of the Potomac. A new team's mowing down the ranks of their opponents. The Nationals are smashing balls, so that the commentator who has the calls has passed the wall to see you later. Let's go, Nats. We've got a game to play. We're gonna win today. Let's go, Nats. We're gonna score. We're gonna win for sure. So call your local congressman. We need another monument. The Nats are rolling on the win roll. D.C. Let's go, Nats.
By the early light of dawn, well, you can see they're running scared, 'cause the kinds of bombs we're launching are bursting in the air. Tell the Library of Congress that they might not want to look, 'cause we're putting curly W's in every book. Let's go, Mets. We've got a game to play. We're gonna win today. Let's go, Mets. We're gonna score for score. We're gonna win for sure. You better tell your senator we're shredding the competitors. We're set to send the pennant home for old D.C. Let's go, Mets. Let's go, Mets. Let's go, Mets. Let's go, Mets.
Let's go.
So raise and tell the president we hold this truth self-evident. The Nats are gonna represent Virginia up to Maryland and old D.C. Let's go, Nats.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.